How do you describe yourself now, politically and religiously?
I describe myself as a very proud and happy American citizen, firmly in support of democratic political institutions. And I make a distinction between our political system and our economic system. I'm not as enthusiastic about the relevancy of our economic system as I am about our political system. I think that we're in trouble in our economic system, but I'm working for a new consensus and a new majority as to the stability of democratic political institutions. Spiritually, I am a Christian, but one who is not narrow-minded and to the exclusion of other denominations or even other religions.
You were born again while you were in exile.
Right.
What happened?
Well, it was really a long process, and when I try to describe what happened, we always have to begin with, first of all, coming from under the influence of the materialist Marxist philosophy, and then being spiritually stimulated by the birth of my two children. That's really what started spiritual sparks to flying in my life. And eventually, I returned to the faith of my youth. I was born into a family where both my grandfathers were preachers, and my mother's father was a Methodist preacher, my father's father was a Baptist preacher. And I rejected that during my early teens and became an atheist and went out into the world. And so my experiences subsequently led me back to that faith.
Was it a moment where you felt like you saw the light and something snapped?
I definitely had an experience, a spiritual experience, some people say mystical experience, but it was a point where everything fell together. And I had been leading up to that. I came to the conclusion and understanding that there was a creator, but there was a climactic moment when I saw a vision involving images in the moon. And it was like a change overnight from the person I was the day before into a whole new, fresh outlook and approach to life.
That experience coincided with your coming back to the States.
It was really that experience was the deciding factor in it, because up until then, I wasn't willing to entertain the idea of going to prison. And there was no way to come back to the United States without going to prison. I had actually tried many times with my lawyers to get my case dealt with or to get my bail reinstated, and it was not possible to do that. So I was faced with the idea, prospect of going to prison immediately, and I didn't want to do that. But after that experience, I was very eager to do that, because in that experience, there was some assurance that I didn't have anything to worry about, that I would come to prison, but I would get out. And so that's what I did.
And what did happen?
Well, I surrendered, and I returned to the United States on November the 19th of 1975. I was immediately incarcerated, and I remained behind bars for 9 months. And that gave time for my case to get back on track, because I had been gone for about 8 years. And I had many different court proceedings, and finally I won a habeas corpus action, which removed my parole hold that they had on me. This entitled me to bail. And at that point, a very active evangelist businessman from Philadelphia, by the way, named Art DeMoss, he put up $100,000 for my bail. And that's how I got out on bail. And from then on, it was just a process of going to court and having the case pared down by eliminating many charges that were baseless from the beginning. And finally, it ended up with a plea bargain. And I was offered a plea bargain as soon as I came back, but it would take me to prison. And so I rejected that. And finally, when the case really began to fall apart, I was offered a plea bargain that gave me 2,000 hours of community service, which is like 8 hours a day, 5 days a week for 1 year. It's 1 year's labor. And I've just completed that. And very soon, I will have my discharge from the case.
As we record this now, it's the last day of your parole.
This is the day that I'm supposed to receive the discharge.
Well, how do those 9 months when you returned to the States in prison compare with the, was it 9 years that you'd spent in prison before?
Well, qualitatively, it's about the same because the bottom line of being in prison is boredom. And you've heard of being bored to death. And I can really understand how that's possible because being slowed down to a crawl or to zero is really a painful process. And sitting in a cage waiting for something to happen is a very painful process. But when you spend a lot of time in prison, as I have done, you tend to become seasoned to it or callous about it so that it doesn't hurt as much as someone who's never been there before. So a lot of people come there for the first time, they really just go up the wall, can't hardly stand it. But a guy who's sort of a professional, like I have become, can just sit down and cool it, you know. So it wasn't that destructive because in the first place, it was kind of a soft entry back into the United States after being absent for 8 years. I think it helped to cushion the culture shock a little bit.
Probably a lot of the prisoners and even a lot of the guards not only knew about you, but had even read your book, Soul on Ice. What kinds of things did they want to know about from you?
Well, I had only one. I had a bad experience there because as soon as I came back, the Black Panther Party held a press conference, and they announced that they had some secret information that I was an FBI agent and a CIA agent, and they warned the black community to stay away from me and asked the black community not to help me. Well, I was sitting in the tank with a lot of people who were in there because of the FBI, so that they looked at me, and some of them, I guess, believed it, and some of them didn't. So that sort of compounded my situation. Then there were some very hostile guards there, some of whom really wanted to do me in. And there were some others who were just indifferent and some who were really sort of, you know, like autograph seekers, which was strange. And so I had a mixed experience in there. What can I say? It was touch and go situation, but nothing bad happened to me, and eventually I was released.
You treated differently when you're Eldridge Cleaver celebrity as opposed to Eldridge Cleaver in the days before people really knew who you were?
Really, quite obviously that happens, you know, because, particularly because I was charged with shooting policemen, this, sad to say, but in prison, a guy who shoots a policeman is sort of a hero, you know, and people sort of look a little with awe. You're in a lot of trouble, too, you know. And then the guards don't like it at all. So it's that kind of a situation. And then if you're well known, and there was special circumstances that I was a member of the Black Panther Party, so there's something of the aura of a political prisoner about that. So my experience was quite unique.
What do you think the Panthers held that press conference to say that you were an agent?
Well, because
there was, with them.
There was ill will between myself and the persons who did that, which went back to the internal struggles that we had gone through in the Black Panther Party. We had a very nasty split in the Black Panther Party that even resulted in bloodshed on both sides. And so I was like a ghost returning from beyond, a survivor and a potential reviver. I guess they looked at it that way. And at that time, they had a very cozy thing going. The Black Panther Party had been absorbed into the Democratic Party in Oakland, California in particular. And they had become legitimized. They were on Governor Brown's invitation list. They were invited to the governor's mansion and to all of the regular Democratic Party functions. The different people who were in office in the Black Panther Party were delegates to the National Democratic Party Convention in 1976 and things like that. So the Black Panther Party had become politically and socially acceptable in California. But that was not the Black Panther Party that I was a part of. So that when I came back, I was bad news to the Black Panther Party people. And so they attacked me when I came back.
And you were also, I think, attacked by people who suspected that your newfound Christianity was just a ruse to get back under with a different kind of identity to the States, and that your newfound patriotism was also a cover in the hopes of getting treated better by the system, by the police, by the courts. How did you respond to that?
Well, that really used to trouble me a lot. It used to hurt me. First of all, it used to hurt me when they called me a cop, you know, because that clashed with my convict's pride, you know. But it's more serious when they call you like an active agent. That's a problem. And then when they just attack your whole credibility by saying that you're only doing it to curry favor with the courts or to fix your case or something like that, it's very difficult to disprove that. And how can you go about disproving that? So it casts an aura of suspicion over you. And the only thing that can overcome that is the passage of time, so they can see how your case is really handled. Now, I think that's unfortunate, because really my case was handled in a very, astute manner. And because I've had experience with the judicial system, I've had a couple of jury trials in the past, and I know how it works and so forth. I think that people interested in the system could have been instructed by watching how my case was handled from my point of view, and also from the point of view of the legal help that I had, because the whole thing was done in the light of day. There was nothing underhand, that no deals were made. And I think that people could have benefited by watching the strategy that was employed and so forth. But unfortunately, many people just chose to throw mud. And because these were my former comrades, people who were not close to the scene were influenced by that and sort of took the word of these people for that. So it really has been a challenging experience for me.
Do you think you're trusted in activist or leftist circles?
Well, that's what I said. My point is that these circles don't really exist anymore in their integrity as they once did in solid blocks in the past. I'm not seeking credibility in leftist circles or any other circles. And I just say what I have to say, take the positions that I have to take, and let it go at that. But I find many people who were part of the anti-war movement, who were part of the Black Liberation Movement, they've all gone on to other things now. Many of them hold elected office. Many of them hold political appointee slots, you know. I had a very strange experience. I walked into the Bank of America in San Francisco, and there was a guy with a very neatly trimmed beard. He walked up from behind the counter, and he said, "Mr. Cleaver, I want to tell you that I used to really admire you, but now I hate your guts." I was shocked to see somebody behind the counter saying this to me, and I asked him, "Well, why?" And he told me, "Because of my politics now." So I asked him, was he robbing the bank? What was he doing behind the counter? And he was the assistant branch manager. And when I reminded him of that, that was quite different from what he seemed to have been doing in the past, the guy just turned real red, like it was the first time he'd ever put that together. So I find many people who themselves have gone into the machinery of the society and working in corporations and working in radio stations and TV stations and newspapers and things like that, and yet they poke their mouths out at me as though I'm interrupting the revolution or something. And I have to remind them that I was the last one to come down from the mountains, that when I came back in 1975, there was no overt struggle going on. And really, I think I paved the way for many other people to come back. Bernadine Dorn came back. Abby Hoffman came back. Huey Newton came back. And many of those people, particularly Huey Newton, when I came back, they criticized me. And then when they saw that things were working out in a positive manner, they came back. So a lot of times I just ignore people, because many times people don't know what the hell they're talking about.
Eldridge Cleaver is my guest, if you're just joining us. you know, every few months somebody writes an article in a magazine about like what's become of the yeah. activists and militants yes. of the 60s. And of course, you and Bobby Seale are always used as two examples of how people change. Bobby Seale's recently written a cookbook called Barbecuing with Bobby. And you're now born again, and you're wearing an American flag on the lapel of your suit, which is, I think, symbolic of what you call your new faith in the American system. What do you think that says, the fact that people have changed? Do you think that indicates that either that those beliefs in the 60s were never really deep enough or never really could have worked?
I don't think that at all. I think that we won victories in the 60s, but the American system has a strange way of handing out victories, you know. People who struggle and pioneer are very seldom rewarded themselves, but the cause that they stand for often triumphs. And I think that that's what happened in our case. Eventually, the war was stopped in Vietnam, which was very important to the movement. And the situation of black people, I think, changed for the better, radically for the better. And so this is satisfying to me to see the climate in America now on those issues as opposed to the climate back in the 60s. What is sad about it is the antagonism between the people who were involved in the movement. I think that this shows that the work of the FBI, for instance, their counterintelligence program, was really successful in driving wedges between people. As a matter of fact, I believe that it's tragic because if the people who made common cause with each other in the past were able to work together now, they could become the decisive power balance in this country. They could actually take control of many of the city and state governments and even go on to higher office. And so a lot of them are still wallowing in the slogans of the 60s, and they haven't realized that we're now in the 80s. And they need to disassociate themselves from a lot of the attitudes and political stances that we took in the past and come up with programs and policies that can solve the problems that are confronting people now, instead of all of this backbiting and backstabbing that I believe that this generation of leftists is going to end up like many of the others. You'll find people in the old left still arguing about Stalin and Trotsky, you know, and hating each other until the grave. And this is tragic to me and utterly stupid. And I think it's a betrayal of everything that they were supposedly standing for.
Do you think the new left has their equivalent arguments?
I think they do the same thing. They look to me like their grandfathers and grandmothers, you know. They're arguing over slogans from the 60s. They're arguing over who was right and who was wrong. Rim 1 and Rim 2 are still at odds, you know, and all that stuff. So that I think they should bury the hatchet and realize that, hey, life moves on. You don't blame people for political decisions that they made. I always say that if Anwar Sadat can get on a plane and fly to talk to Menachem Begin, then why can't we who had disputes with each other here in America bury the hatchet on that and come on and deal with the things that are really threatening the country now?
I think that the part of your life now that's most baffling to people who've followed you is your association with the born-again Christian movement, because politically they tend to be a movement of the right, standing for, well, I know they'd argue it, but they appear to many people to be a kind of segregationist, racist, anti-feminist, anti-homosexual movement.
I think that's accurate to say that. But there's a problem. The same problem is there that exists on the point of patriotism. I think that people on the left who reject patriotism because, for instance, you know, Spiro Agnew always wore the American flag in his lapel. Richard Nixon wore the American flag in his lapel. So we run around with the Viet Cong flag. Well, that might be good for a demonstration, but for people who are seriously concerned about achieving power in America and changing America and winning over the American people, this is a very dim strategy because you're alienating yourself from your heritage, from your traditions. And so I've learned the wisdom of not doing that. And I think that it's ridiculous to allow yourself to be stripped of the symbols of your own heritage, your own country, out of political arguments with, reactionaries or whatever you want to call them. So I think that we should dispute the possession of this land and not concede it or its symbols to the political opposition. And as relates to spiritual things and God and religion, it's even more insane to allow conservatives or reactionaries to run away with God, to run away with religion just because you don't like their politics. I think that a person can be spiritual, can be religious, can believe in God, can be born again, and still have a good, sound human politics. And so I think that what I want to do is to encourage other people to abandon some of these stupid positions and take some of the wholesome positions that can involve them with the larger circle of American people.
Eldridge Cleaver is my guest, if you're just joining us. Several years ago, I think Jerry Falwell invited you up to speak to his congregation. What did you say to his congregation?
Well, I just described my conversion. I described my experiences in traveling and living in communist countries as contrasted with my revolutionary activity against America. And I must say that I had a very warm reception in Jerry Falwell's church, and I met people from walks of life that I was never able to meet before. For instance, he took me in a back room and he introduced me to a man who's a member of his congregation who was formerly the regional head of the Ku Klux Klan. And this man embraced me, and I could see him as a brother, and he could see me as a brother. And another man was there who was formerly a Secret Service man who was chasing the Ku Klux Klan and the Black Panther Party. So it's that kind of a situation. And I believe that it's good to be able to have bridges between people. I seem to be inclined to want to build bridges between the people who are the most extremely alienated from me. I think that's one of the problems that we have in America, the alienation between people.
But is that an effective bridge? I mean, they might have shook your hand and embraced you because they figured that you had seen a light and share of their political
views. I said he was a former Ku Klux Klan. I didn't say he was an active, okay? So I think that out of all the accusations that have been leveled against me, no one as yet has accused me of being a Ku Klux Klanman, you know. I wouldn't put it past some people to do that. But, I felt very good and warm about being invited to speak in Jerry Falwell's church. I like Jerry Falwell. I think that he stands for some very good, sound values. I don't agree with all of his political positions because some of them are what I call reactionary. I think it's a mistake to confuse a reactionary with a conservative, because I think a conservative is a nice, sound person who believes in something. And the term conservative really means that you found something that you think is worthy of being conserved. And I found something that I think is worthy of being conserved. So I don't mind if someone calls me a conservative. But what I think is what people are driving at when they use the term conservative, they're really talking about a reactionary who wants to deprive people of their just rights or who wants to turn the clock back or stop human progress and things like that.
Do you agree with his stand and the moral majority stand on social issues, on family issues, abortion, feminism, homosexuality?
Well, I think that I share a concern. However, I'm a little different than a lot of people on these issues. For instance, I was with a group of conservatives, Jerry Falwell included, at a meeting, and they were all talking about the criminal nature of abortion and so forth. So I asked them how they feel about contraception, because philosophically speaking, there's very little difference between aborting a fetus and using contraceptive devices to prevent the fetus from forming in the first place. both actions interrupt the life process. And many of these evangelists admit that their wives use various forms of contraception, which effectively achieves the same thing as abortion achieves. And they equate abortion with killing an adult. They think it's the same thing. If you kill a fetus or if you kill a baby who's 1 month old, they think it's the same thing. Or if you kill a person who's 10 years old or 20 years old, it's the same as killing a fetus. Well, by that same logic, I don't see much difference in extending the crime back another degree. If you kill a fetus and it's a crime, why isn't it a crime to keep the fetus from forming in the first place? So I think that there's a morality of convenience involved in some of these charges, and it overlooks the human plight involved. So that my approach to this whole subject is that I believe that birth control and contraception is really a male problem, that men are the carriers of sperm, and I think that they're the ones who should be responsible for instituting an economy of sperm and not to put women in a position where they have to mutilate their bodies and take in a lot of unsafe substances in order to avoid pregnancy. It's involved with recreational sex and so forth. So I think that an approach to birth control that puts the responsibility on the male for being able to control the dispensation of sperm is where the hope lies, because I don't like abortion and I don't like contraception.
You don't like contraception?
I don't like contraception.
So you're talking about abstinence?
No, I'm talking about a man being able to control his ejaculation, which is possible.
Mm.
I know women don't trust it. I know that.
Why should they?
Well, that's what I'm saying. That's why it can't be left to them.
Yeah.
Because women take the attitude that stamp it out. You know, if they don't want to become pregnant at this time, then they're prepared to just blow it all away. And I think that that's a bad attitude. And since they have that attitude, I prefer to take the problem out of their hands.
I remember hearing a speech of yours, I think it was in Rochester, New York, probably in around 1969. And you used the term pussy power and said that basically women, revolutionary women, their greatest power was to either give or to withhold sex from the men in the revolution, and that would really be an inspiration or a deterrent to the men, and it was really the greatest force that they had. What do you think of that now?
Well, I regret having said it, because in a way, I think I had a role in stimulating women into becoming more active as women. And I say that because at that time, I had a problem, okay? I was involved in organizational activity that involved, like, white organizations as well as black. And I noticed that if I wanted to have a really good conversation, I could get it from the white men involved in these movements, okay? But the women were doing all the work. Plus, the women were more radical than the men, I noticed that. And the men were, you know, slowing down on many different issues. And the women were very dissatisfied, because I saw that they were interested in issues that went beyond the issues that the men were interested in. And I saw this as a very potentially radical, revolutionary. And so I wanted to unleash that as much as possible, because my own goals were much more revolutionary than the topical things like stopping the war and so forth. So at that time, women would be just beginning to form what they call female caucuses inside of male-dominated organizations. That used to be the term that was used. And I used to be welcome at some of their meetings, whereas a lot of the other men were not allowed to come to the meetings. And my purpose for making those speeches was, number one, I had a wide, nationwide platform, and I felt that I could get a message across generally to all the women. And number two, I felt that women were a very revolutionary force in history and in America. So I wanted to do everything I could to unleash that. Now, rhetoric being what it was, I wasn't referring just exclusively to the genitals, okay? I was talking about the impact that women could have on men, the power that women have over men in those kinds of situations. So that I was saying that women should put pressure on the men to force them to be more radical and to embrace these other issues with more enthusiasm, and that they could do that by withholding their relationship from them. And I must say that it works. It works. And I think women know that it works. And in a political situation, I think it had a lot of impact. Now, you have to keep that in a time frame, because as things developed, then women began to look upon the rhetoric that I was using and that whole thing as something that they didn't like anymore, because it was sort of looking at them as sex objects and so forth. But anyone who would make an honest assessment of that, who would look at it in the time frame in which I was speaking, wouldn't be able to draw that same condemnation. But now, these days, women might look at that same speech that I made then and say, look at this guy, how he's talking. You know? I don't talk that way anymore.
It is such a kind of complete reversal. And I think women would say that you're still defining what a woman's role should be before saying that it's a kind of sexual power, and now saying that that if you get pregnant through sex, you can't have any control over.
Well, I don't buy a lot of stuff that women are saying these days. Okay, and I think that men have been badgered down to a great extent in some ways that I think are unacceptable. I'm in favor of women having freedom, you know, and all of that, but I'm not in favor of the coming matriarchy, for instance. I'm not in favor of women being able to push men around. And so I feel that I have the right to try to define the situation just as well as anyone else has the right. Any woman, I can speak on any subject I want to. And I don't at all have in me even the possibility of just towing some ideological line because this is what women are laying down. I don't buy that.
Eldridge Cleaver is my guest if you're just joining us. So getting back to the groups like the Moral Majority, which are comprised mostly of born-again Christians, how do you discuss with them when you speak before a congregation, where you agree and where you disagree with their political and social stance?
Oh, yes. I always do that with everybody that I speak. You know? I think this is important to do that because there's a big problem here. On the one hand, you find all of these Christians who supposedly are you know, believing in Jesus Christ and following Jesus Christ, yet they're supporting policies that are murdering people and killing people and starving people. And there's a contradiction there. And I think that people can space out on Christianity to the extent that it blinds them to reality. And so I like to take the opportunity to point that out. And the reason that I say there's a problem here is because I believe that the correct line for action in the world in our time, we're caught up in a world in revolution. I believe that this revolution has an aspect to it that's revolutionary. It is national, it is international, and it is spiritual. And we have neglected the spiritual aspect in the past. And this comes from a lot of ideological influence that is materialistic and atheistic. And what I really feel in common with the Moral Majority and other people has to do with their love for America and has to do with their spiritual adherence and allegiance to the gospel of Jesus Christ. But the way that they implement those items, I disagree in many instances with them.
We're running out of time, but very briefly, what do you think of President Reagan's actions to date? Do you think he's been a good president?
Well, I think that you know, he's trying to do something that's very difficult to do. But basically, comparing him with what Jimmy Carter was not doing, I think that Reagan has taken the reins of our problems in hand, and he's grappling with them. So I'm appreciative of that at this point.
Your period of probation ends today.
Today.
And by today, I mean the day that we're recording, which is September 29th.
Yes.
Is your life going to change a lot, assuming that
I think I'll be a lot more active. There are relationships that I can enter into now, contractual and so forth, which I couldn't before. I'm free to travel without having to calculate an appointment with my probation officer, this kind of thing. Plus, I'm freer to go up against the political machine in Oakland, California, and I plan to run for mayor there against the machine that now controls Oakland. And that same machine controls the probation department. So without that particular chain around my leg, I think that I'll be a little freer, yes.
What kind of platform will you be running on in political and social issues?
Well, we need to liberate Oakland from a lot of the traditional influences. The struggle that has been going on there for many years was really aborted by this bourgeois black mayor that we now have. So my programs will be oriented to helping the people secure, for instance, their food supply, their access to housing. So people have a money problem in Oakland, high unemployment, very high crime, and much of it I blame on the black leadership there. That, you know, we always blame everything on the white man, but really there's much room for constructive activity, and the thing that's missing in Oakland is some leadership that's able to inspire the young people, able to provide programs for the youth, and also to inspire the people who are unemployed and on relief and so forth to go to work and do the work that's available. There's a lot of work available, but many people prefer to see people come in from Mexico to do that work while they remain on the dole. But I think that they should do the work and have the shortfall supplemented by help from the city, from the state, and what have you. But there are a lot of things that can be done in Oakland, which I plan to do.
You use the word bourgeois to describe the current mayor. What does that word mean to you
It
now?
Means to me that traditionally in the black community, we've had a two-tiered situation where you have a professional class of people, doctors, lawyers, businessmen, people who are making it financially and who are not suffering financially. And beneath them, you have the great majority of grassroots people who have no leadership and who are not represented either by the white politicians or by the black politicians. These are the people that I've always related to. These are the people that I would seek to represent. This is the majority of the black community, and their leadership has been destroyed each time that it has reared its head. And so I think that the task in Oakland is to organize the people on a grassroots basis and address the problems of racial relations, but at the same time address the problem of the relationship between the classes.
Do you think you can be related to as a grassroots leader now, since you've been really a national, international celebrity for so many years? You're the author of a book that was a bestseller. You can dress in fine clothes now. You've lived in countries around the world. And your politics have changed a lot, too.
Yeah, but you see, when I say grassroots, that's because that's where my heart lies. And you can talk with kings and queens. If you don't lose the common touch, it doesn't change your character. So I think that I'm dedicated to that, and that's the kind of guy that I am, and that's the kind of guy that I will remain. And people are the ones who can decide that. The black bourgeoisie doesn't particularly like me, and they've always found problems with me because I've always articulated a critique against them. And I think this critique is very precious, and it's important because it's the cutting edge of the desires and needs of the grassroots black people. They're the ones who are bearing the brunt of the cuts in the welfare and all of the other deprivation. When you talk of being the last hired and the first fired, you're talking about the grassroots people in the black community. And they're the ones that I love and that I want to help.
In
spite of my clothes.
We're about out of time, but you've talked about your faith in the American system now, and as I mentioned, you're wearing an American flag on your lapel. How do you think that the system has worked for you?
Well, I think that the American system is the freest and the most democratic system in the world. I think that historically, the system has always responded to challenges by resolving the contradictions and by including...
I mean, for you personally.
Well, me personally, I just fit into a class of people. But for me personally, I think I've had $1 million or two pass through my hands. I've made a lot of money in America, and I've spent it on the movement, on the revolution. And I think that life is wonderful in America. We have a lot of problems, but I've had a chance to see the rest of the world, and I believe that what oppression we have in America, the people who are oppressed between two pieces of silk. And I don't think they understand that. We have people here living in the ghettos in houses that you'd have to be very well off to live in other countries. So I think people need to get out of their houses, get off of their butts, clean up their yards, clean up their houses, clean up their streets, clean up all the garbage on the walls, and we'd have a very beautiful America. Things are not as bad as we make it out to seem in America. Poverty really doesn't exist in America if you know what poverty really is on a world scale. So I think that we are poverty, but a lot of the poverty is in our minds and in our concepts of what we do have.
Elders Cleaver, thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me here.